This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you have a diversity of resources, you have wind in different locations, you have solar in different locations, you have quick ramping natural gas, that all of that works together to keep the system running.
A couple of decades ago, who could have imagined that a gust of wind wafting across a Wyoming plain could power an air conditioner as far off as Southern California? But it very well may be happening soon. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with Shalini Ramanathan, a Texas-based wind energy consultant who gives us a peek into new advances in the wind industry and how these are enabling wind to blow open our nation's interstate power grid. Then we hear from the mayor of Sebastopol, California, who told us last year about how his town passed some controversial yet effective solar power ordinances to get off of fossil fuels and make this humble municipality a trailblazer in the shift to sustainability. To all the ladies in the place with style and grace. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shalini Ramanathan. She's a VP of Development for RES Americas. Shalini, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
First, why don't you tell us what you do, what RES Americas is all about?
RES Americas is a developer and constructor of wind and solar projects. We focus on utility scale projects, so the really big projects you see if you're in Tehachapi in California or in West Texas. We recently completed construction of a 40 megawatt solar project for OCI in San Antonio that's supplying power to people for city public service in that city, San Antonio. And we also closed a number of deals last year for wind projects in Texas and Oklahoma.
In terms of the large wind projects around the globe, which have you and your colleagues most excited in terms of capacity and efficiency?
I'm excited by a lot of different developments. I think the wind industry is growing by leaps and bounds. I think that some of the offshore efforts in Europe are really interesting. The large projects that are taking advantage of very strong offshore coastal winds. Here in the U.S., we're seeing transmission build-out in Texas, where I'm based. We recently saw the completion of the competitive renewable energy zones, the CREZ zones. It's $6.8 billion of investment in transmission lines that are connecting the windy plains of West Texas with the load centers in the central and eastern parts of the state. Similarly, in the Southwest Power Pool, which is parts of the Midwest and the West, there's a really significant effort underway to build out transmission, which I know isn't very exciting to anyone but a wind developer. But it's exciting because it unlocks those wind resources and connects them to the folks who can use the power that they generate.
And so tell us about some of the potential and the current state of the selling of wind power across state lines. I've read about how Wyoming is hoping to sell wind power to California, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are some significant projects underway. The one that you mentioned, the Anschutz project, is certainly one of them. They're hoping to export power from the windy plains of Wyoming to California. Another really interesting development are these utilities in the southeast United States, such as Tennessee Valley Authority and Southern Company, some of their companies, Georgia Power. And others that have been signing power purchase agreements for wind power from Oklahoma and Kansas. I think that that's a really exciting development because the Southeast does not have its own wind resources. So being able to export power from these windy Midwestern states to the Southeast is a really cool development.
So what has changed? Because a decade ago, the idea of long distance delivery of wind power was kind of a pipe dream. But we're talking about Wyoming delivering power to Southern California. How's that possible?
Well, I think there are a couple of things in terms of what's changed. One thing that's changed is that due to better technology, taller towers, we're seeing higher net capacity factors. We're seeing wind turbines that are far more energetic than they were even just 6 years ago. And the impact of that to a utility in the Southeast is that the cost of power is really low. So it's very attractive if you are a utility that does not face any kind of procurement, green power procurement target. What really moves you to do it is a competitive price, and perhaps you do it because it's a hedge against increasing fossil fuel prices. To the second part of your question, electrons are electrons, and it's impossible, as you know, given all the work you do on sustainability, to really track whether something injected in state X really ends up in state Y. So the other significant development are financial settlement mechanisms where power is injected in X in point X, and there are settlement mechanisms in states such as California to sort of acknowledge that the addition of that power and to pay any difference, if any, for that green power.
So as the price has begun to plummet in, with wind power, as the scale begins to increase, where do we stand right now in terms of federal subsidies for wind power?
Sure. I think it's no secret that the federal production tax credit has been a key driver for the success of wind power. It's been enormously successful in bringing down the price of power, of wind power. And that, of course, has lots of ancillary economic benefits. It brings jobs and investment dollars to communities that host the projects. It leads to manufacturing jobs. At this point, more than 70% of the wind turbine components are made in the U.S., which has certainly a positive economic impact. So my view is that we're not, you know, Res Americas and myself, we're not trying to do a project a year and kind of slowly transform the system. Res and companies like ours are very focused on transforming the energy system. And you just don't do that overnight. So we strongly believe that extension of the production tax credit is essential to continue the transformation. You know, we don't want to stop at 60,000 gigawatts of wind. We want to triple that in the coming years.
So critics of alternative energy look at the federal subsidies for electric power by source, and then they see that this is in 2011, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, and obviously that's changed quite a bit in the last couple of years. But just a couple of years ago, oil and gas got 64 cents on the dollar per megawatt hour, hydropower 82 cents, coal 64 cents, nuclear $3.14 per megawatt hour, solar $775 per megawatt hour, and wind $56.29 per megawatt hour. Now, that's a couple years old. Where do you see those numbers changing in the next couple of years, Shalini?
Sure. I don't know the specific study that you speak, so I can't comment on the exact levels that you cited there. I think in the future, I think there is a lot of support in DC, even if it's hard to get things done. I think there is broad support for wind power. So our hope and expectation is that the federal production tax credit stays at the same level for a few more years.
And explain how the tax credit works, if you can. Get into the nuts and bolts of it, if you will.
Sure. I think this is one of these issues that isn't well understood outside of the industry. Of course, there are many different ways to incentivize the creation of a renewable energy industry. In Spain and Germany and other European countries, they've used what's called a feed-in tariff. And in fact, it was used in Ontario and Canada, where if you show up with a renewable energy project, and there are some very specific guidelines, then you're paid a premium so that you can you can be confident that your project's economics will work out. that's a system that allows almost anyone to be a developer and to make a project happen. You just sort of need the technical skills and, you know, obviously the capital to bring a project together. In the United States, we have a different system. It's a tax credit system. And what that means is that in order to monetize and unlock the value of the production tax credit, the PTC, you as a developer, are unlikely to have the tax appetite to do that on your own. So the typical procedure is for project developers to, in addition to getting commercial debt from banks, to also seek what's called tax equity from a handful of players. GE is an example of one of them. Morgan Stanley is one of them. And these banks and institutions have tax appetite and are active in the renewable energy space. But I think one thing that a lot of folks who aren't intimately involved in the industry might not understand that the incentive, because it's tax credit driven, really does rely on the participation of a handful of folks with both the tax appetite and the interest in the sector.
So can you give us a ballpark guess of what percent of Texas's overall grid is now wind?
Sure. The Texas grid is about 63,000 megawatts. And the last statistic that I read, this is actually changing very quickly because it's such a big year for wind. But at the end of 2013, there were about 11,000 megawatts of wind installed. And there will be many more, a couple thousand more megawatts by the end of this year. So in terms of capacity, 11 out of 63 is certainly a good chunk. And then in terms of, if you look at megawatt hours in production, one of the interesting things is that the head of ERCOT, and ERCOT is the grid operator here in Texas, has on a couple of occasions pointed out that that wind kicking in on cold winter days has been responsible for the reliability of the system in delivering power during those times when the grid is stressed. So there's no doubt that wind is a significant component of the generation here in Texas.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Shalini Ramanathan. Texas and Wyoming are some of the most productive states in terms of wind generation, but they're also some of the reddest states, although Texas is starting to become a purple state as the state becomes more and more of a melting pot. But the political class is generally Republican, and they've been fairly anti-wind. What do you attribute the success of Texas and Wyoming? Is it just topography?
The wind resource certainly helps. These are obviously very windy states. I work in a number of states that are, what you might characterize as politically red. I work in Oklahoma and Kansas, and so obviously in Texas. And I really think that that wind power is a bipartisan issue. And the reason for its success in these red states is that the resource is great. We're putting up projects that take advantage of really exceptional wind resources, and you have available land. And I think a lot of the landowners really appreciate the off-farm income that follows hosting a wind turbine on their land.
As a
resident of Texas, Shalini, what are some of the most common misconceptions that you hear from friends and colleagues in terms of the reality of wind versus a perception of it?
That's a great question. I think the biggest misconception is that even well-informed friends of mine don't appreciate the state of the technology today. You know, it's not like we're in my offices, we don't sit around hoping that someone develops a better technology so we can do more projects. We're focused on how to deploy the technology that we have today. And when I tell friends about how we're, you know, how hub heights are getting higher, i.e. we're going up even higher to take advantage of shear factors, and how blade technology has improved, and how, you know, how good turbines today are, I think that people are surprised that we don't have more projects.
Let me read you this quote from one of the congressmen from Texas, Representative Joe Barton. He's the House author of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. I don't know if he's currently, but he's been chairman of the House Senate Energy Conference Committee. He said, "Wind is a finite resource, and harnessing it would slow the winds down, which would cause the temperature to go up." Now, I don't think that's a quote I would even hear from my six-year-old daughter. How do we get a sane energy policy when we have representatives who can say things so staggeringly ignorant?
Yeah, I was listening today to a story about how there are people doubting that climate change is real just because we've had an unusually cold winter in parts of the U.S. And people aren't making that distinction between weather and the broader pattern of weather, which is climate. And I think the only answer to all of this and misinformation of any kind is, you know, better education, because it just like, you know, using the wind doesn't really raise temperatures or diminish the wind in a similar way. You know, obviously, a cold spell doesn't diminish the reality that we have a global warming crisis.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Shalini Ramanathan. She is a VP of Development for RES Americas, which is a leading developer and constructor of wind projects. So, Shalini, you talked about the increasing height of turbines. Can you talk about the never-ending struggle in terms of what is often referred to as NIMBYism, not in my backyard? How does that affect rollout of projects that you and your colleagues are engaged on?
We've been very fortunate in my company and on my team to find communities that are very supportive of our efforts. And that's important to us, that people want to see this development in their backyard. I think where NIMBYism is a challenge is less often for wind projects, at least in my neck of the woods, and more often for transmission. Transmission lines, which, as I mentioned, are just essential to getting wind power to load centers, are just not very popular. No one really buys a ranch and, you know, hopes for a view of an overhead line. So that, I think, that Gentai's support for big transmission projects, that I think is where NIMBYism is a factor.
So one of the criticisms against wind and solar has been their intermittency, but we've actually seen wind really be an important aid in bolstering the grid during a cold snap like this. How does it work, despite the wind maybe not blowing all the time?
The modern electrical grid is an incredibly complex system, and the people operating it are, in my view, just heroes in making everything run. And the way that wind and solar contribute every day, including days that are harder for system operators than others, such as cold snaps, is just by providing a diversity of resource. So, for example, if you have an extreme cold snap, as we did in February, Texas, a couple of years ago in 2011, and some of your coal plants are not running, then having wind online that is running just helps keep the system operating overall. So I think the key word there is diversity. If you have a diversity of resources, you have wind in different locations, you have solar in different locations, you have quick ramping natural gas, that all of that, and you of course have demand response on the consumer side. You have really effective solutions for reducing usage at peak times. All of that works together to keep the system running. There isn't sort of a silver bullet solution. It's just diversifying the generation and managing consumption to keep the system stable overall.
Shalini Ramanathan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Kies. He is the mayor of Sebastopol, California, and a retired energy consultant. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So Sebastopol is a small town north of San Francisco, and it was just in the news because you recently passed an ordinance regarding new homes and solar panels. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about it?
It actually is all new buildings, and we now have a requirement that new buildings install solar panels. And the overall concept is that these buildings install enough solar so that they don't generate any greenhouse gases.
And walk us through the evolution of the legislation.
Sebastopol has a history of interest in photovoltaic solar. And in 2002, we actually had a group of Sonoma State students do a survey of all the rooftops in Sebastopol and how many were reasonable, had reasonable solar access. Sebastopol itself, virtually every municipal building has solar on it. The swimming pool, the police department, the fire department, city hall, the community center, all have solar. And on a per capita basis, we have the highest solar penetration in the nation, or very close to it.
And what do you attribute that to? Mostly legislation or just a very solar-friendly community?
Up until now, we actually haven't had any legislation requiring it. But we've been very active in promoting solar, that the city formed an organization called Solar Sebastopol that promoted solar. We've had a couple solar fairs, energy efficiency fairs. We had gotten a couple grants from the state. The second one actually formed Solar Sonoma County, which is a countywide version of what Solar Sebastopol was. And it does a lot of trainings for installers, building inspectors. In Sebastopol, solar is very typical. I think we probably have 300 installations now, which is probably somewhere close to 10% of the buildings. Well, we have 1.2 megawatts of solar installed. That's probably about 20% of our peak power demand. It's fairly significant. I think that it demonstrates that solar really is a viable option, not necessarily to power all your power, but to supply all the peak power that's required.
So critics might look at this ordinance and say, well, why should a town be telling me what I can and cannot put on my house? And this is a rich person's law. How do you respond to that kind of criticism of mandatory solar on new home legislation?
Well, we really only had one person who spoke up saying the ordinance ought to be voluntary, and installing solar on your house is already voluntary. That it's like the state has lots of energy legislation. Back in 1978, when Title 24 was first enacted, it required insulation in buildings. And, you know, a lot of people complained, why should I have insulation in buildings? And then they required double pane windows. This is just part of the evolution of making buildings energy independent.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies. Sebastopol, California is a pretty liberal town, correct?
Yeah, very and progressive.
A sister town to the south, Lancaster, California, which is a right-wing-leaning town politically.
Yeah, they're not really a sister. They're more like a cousin when it comes to solar.
But they did pass something
but
similar.
But they passed the ordinance, and what it really shows is that it's not a political issue, that it's a social issue, that everybody recognizes that climate change is a problem and we need to deal with it. And the liberals can deal with it and the conservatives can deal with the same solutions.
So in terms of the details of the ordinance, do they have to provide for as much as of their electricity by solar? What are kind of the minimums besides just having quote-unquote solar on their house?
Well, there's two methodologies for installing solar. One is a prescriptive method that requires 2 watts per square foot of conditioned building space. And the other is a calculated method, a performance method that requires that you produce 75% of the building's estimated power demands. And it's really actually very simple. I mean, the ordinance itself is very simple. You have your option of doing either. And for residential buildings that you already have to calculate your energy use for Title 24 to calculate the solar system size, you go online and spend 5 minutes. So it's really a very simple calculation added onto what you already have to do. For commercial, there's going to be times when the 2 watts per square foot it makes more sense. Because there's obviously, like if you have a warehouse, you don't need 2 watts per square foot. But if you have a restaurant, you might need 10 watts per square foot and it just won't fit on the roof. So we have options for trying to make it as flexible as possible.
Michael, would an ordinance like this work for a middle or lower income town, unlike Sebastopol, which is a fairly upscale town? How would it break down financially for public housing, for example?
Actually, in Sebastopol, we have quite a bit of low-income housing that we're way over our required quotas from ABAG. And almost all of the new low-income housing in Sebastopol does have solar on it. It's subsidized through the state. The city actually has a fund for low-income housing that the city would help with if there are issues building low-income housing and adding solar. It hasn't been a problem before. And for any kind of market rate housing, when you're adding it into the cost of the overall mortgage, maybe you're looking at an extra $50 a month. But when you're looking at your energy costs, you're saving $150 a month. So it's actually quite a good deal.
The mayor of Sebastopol, California, Michael Kies. Michael, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Alex Wise, Dr. John, and the Beatles. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.